Welcome to Chasing That Neon Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Pope. Join me on each episode as I interview session players, songwriters, sidemen, and women, people with great stories about the music and musicians that so many of us still love. All right, let's get to it. Friends, today I have the honor of speaking with Mr. Ron Haney. He's a widely respected musician from Jackson, Tennessee, and he's a friend of mine. He's also the author of a new book titled The Man Behind the Man in Black, The W.S. Holland Story. This book depicts the life and times of Johnny Cash's longtime friend and drummer known as Fluke Holland. After Johnny passed away, Ron Haney became Fluke's trusted friend, manager, and guitar player in the newly formed W.S. Holland Band. I had the honor of meeting W.S. and Ron years ago when I first moved to Tennessee. My first musician contact in town was a guy named Jack Props, who is also a well-respected drummer, and Jack is a guy who cherishes these legendary musicians just like I do. Well, Jack invited me to see W.S. at a show in Lawrenceburg, Tennessee. I was like, hold on, the guy that played for Johnny Cash? He goes, yeah. He said, let's go. I'll introduce you to him. Well, I was excited as I could be. So we rode down, we went to Lawrenceburg, and after the show, W.S. invited me onto his tour bus, and then to ride with him on the bus to Shoney's. You gotta be kidding me right now, I couldn't believe it. I was so excited. When we got to Shoney's, we were sitting there eating, me, the band, and my friend Jack. W.S. told me to go and get my guitar and play some songs right there in Shoney's. Now, there were a lot of people in there, but that didn't stop me. I went out, got my guitar, brought it back in, and I'll never forget how I sat at that table with all the people around, and I played a song while this white-haired big man who was once Johnny Cash's drummer slapped out his iconic train beat on the table right next to a plate of bacon. In my head, I was thinking, that's the same guy who played for Carl Perkins on Blue Suede Shoes. He played at Sun Studio when Elvis walked in and jammed with all of those boys in what became known as the Million Dollar Quartet. W.S. played on Ring of Fire. I mean, everybody knows that song. He kept the beat at Johnny's prison shows, Folsom, San Quentin. He played for presidents, the Queen of England, all over the world. And now, for goofy little me, here at a table at Shoney's in Lawrenceburg, Tennessee. Now, I never would have had this opportunity if it weren't for Jack Props inviting me to ride down with him to Lawrenceburg, Tennessee to see this show and get to meet W.S. Holland. Of course, Jack knew W.S., so it made it pretty easy to end up on the bus and wind up at Shoney's. What I didn't know that night was the show would have never even happened if it weren't for someone else who was sitting at that table, Ron Haney. I had no idea how important Ron was behind the scenes in keeping Fluke out there in front of people. I'm not the only guy to have experienced W.S. like that. Almost anybody who met him and sat with him long enough had the same experience I had. He was warm, witty, and the perfect mix between Southern charm and an old country boy who could call out B.S. in his own way, even without the B.S. or knowing. My relationship with W.S. grew as he went on to join me and play as a guest drummer at the Bluebird Cafe. He also joined me and my band on Music City Roots, and at Renfro Valley in Kentucky, we did a big show in Gallatin one time on the square. Ron Haney was there for all of those. Of course, I can't forget, I got to record at Sun Studio with Fluke Holland in Memphis back in 2013. That's where it all began for him with Carl Perkins, and there I was back in that same room with him recording my songs. What an honor. W.S. and Ron continued to do shows all over the world, even late into W.S.'s life. He just wanted to play and he didn't care where. There were people calling and Ron did everything he could to get him and W.S., whether it was in a bus, in a van, or on an airplane, wherever they could go to go play. In September of 2020, I reached out to Ron about setting up an interview with both him and W.S. Sadly, it was then that Ron informed me that W.S. was very sick. That next day, I found out that sadly our drumming hero and friend had passed on to the other side. A few months later, Ron Haney and I were able to get together and we had this wonderful conversation that you're about to hear. I almost forgot we were recording it a few times. I'm so happy to be able to share it with y'all, and I have to say, Ron has always been the perfect guy next to W.S. Holland, and I'm so grateful that he invested time and energy into preserving Fluke's unique story and drumming style, along with Carl Perkins and Johnny Cash's musical legacy. Ron is a great guitar player, a music preservationist, a radio DJ, but he's an even better man. I can't wait for y'all to get to know him, so let's get to it. Hey, Ron. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing good, man. Good to see you.
Yeah, you too. This is such an honor, Ron. Thank you so much for taking time for this.
The honor is mutual, man. Always glad to do something like this.
Yeah, absolutely.
Excited about your new podcast. That's excellent.
Well, thank you. I'm excited myself. It's it's something I've kind of wanted to do for a long time. As a matter of fact, I didn't realize that it was leading me to this, but when I was hanging out with Fluke and you and people like y'all, I would sit there so fascinated with this stuff, and then I started listening to podcasts, and I realized that this is just something I had to do. Well, we'll jump into it here a little bit with you. First of all, thank you for taking time to be on here, and it's an honor to talk to you, Ron. I've had the privilege of being on stage with you several times, and you've always just been an absolute pro and a great guy to be around, so it's cool to talk to you tonight.
Thank you, man. The feeling's mutual, Adam. Always good to work with you, whether it's playing music or doing something like this. So
yeah,
we've always enjoyed, and Fluke always enjoyed us all working together, too. So
Special memories. Very special memories. You know, I want to start with, first of all, there's a book that you were a part of working with him on his book. Is that correct?
Yeah, basically what the book consists of is the life and career that he had and lived, and basically he told me, and I wrote it down and put it in story form, and so I say both of us wrote it and really did, but he had the advantage of living at first.
Right.
So.
Well, I had the excitement of listening to the audio version of this, and I went through it, and just absolutely loved it. For those of you who are into old rock and roll history, Johnny Cash, obviously, and I haven't even mentioned. So W.S. Holland, for those who might know, I just assume people know, but you know, W.S. Holland was the drummer of the Tennessee Three, and he backed Johnny Cash for 30, 40 years almost. Is that right?
37 years to be exact.
37.
From 1960 to 1997, when John retired from the road in October of that year. So he was there for pretty much the duration. And a lot of people don't realize they worked together at Sun Records, too, from 55 through 59. And then John called him, and he went to work with John from then on.
So let's talk about, I want to start with, on the book it says Man Behind the Man in Black.
Right.
And it's, W.S.'s life with Johnny Cash. But I want to start with your life with W.S. Holland, whom I got to know over the years. And, we lost Fluke. I hate to even talk about it in a past tense sense, but we lost him a few months ago, and here in summer of 2020. And I don't know if I would have ever gotten to meet Fluke, or if many people would have, if it weren't for Ron Haney. Ron, let's talk about how you met Fluke and how you got to working together, if you'd like.
I got a little frog in my throat tonight, so if I have to clear my throat a lot, I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay, man.
Okay.
Hope you're feeling all right.
Doing fine. Doing
good.
Fluke and I officially met in 2008. I was playing with a band that was headed up by Rayburn Anthony, who is an old son artist, just like Fluke. As a matter of fact, Fluke took him to Memphis and got his recording contract too. But anyway, I was playing guitar for Rayburn Anthony, and our drummer at the time had to miss a show we were doing. So Rayburn, being good friends with W.S. Holland, called W.S. and he said, sure, I'll come set in. This was in 2008. So we played the first show that night that we'd ever worked together. And all during the show, I looked back. He was over to my right behind me on the drums. And I just look around like I always do with all the musicians, you know. He'd give me a thumbs up, you know,
yeah,
several times. So once the show was over and we, you know, last song was done, everybody said goodnight. We were starting to pack up, and WS come down off the drums immediately and walked over to me and said, it's really nice working with you. I like the way you play, and it was a lot of fun, blah, blah, blah. He said, there's only one thing wrong with it. He said it should have happened 30 years ago. So we wow. became instant friends that night and remained good friends up until his passing back in September of this year. So when I come around, he had been working with the Tennessee Three even after John had retired and passed away. And they had a pretty active career. They were doing a lot of shows all across Canada and here in the U.S., and that particular incarnation of the Tennessee Three went away, and Fluke came home, and he was pretty much resigned just to play around here in Jackson, Tennessee, in the surrounding area with some of the local bands and some of the VFWs and stuff.
Right.
And we put together a project. I had a couple of guys from Branson come over and moved here and played guitar and bass. They were really good. And then another gentleman from up in Kentucky, Frank Hamilton, came and did his Johnny Cash interpretation, and it was really good. I mean, he sounded really like Johnny Cash.
Wow.
But that didn't pan out either. So I told him, I said, look, what we need to do is just put together a band, you know, and I said, we'll call it the W.S. Holland Band. And I'll get on the phone and see if we can't book some shows and maybe do a few things, you know. Well, that turned into about 12 years of touring the world and playing shows,
yeah,
and just living the dream, basically having a lot of fun, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And we became good friends. Our wives became good friends. Joyce and Darlene's my wife. And so we all traveled together and just, as Joyce would say, we were making memories. And so that's what we did for 13 years.
Well, you got to go to Europe. I saw you were, yeah, you got to do a lot of stuff in Europe and all over the country here in the United States. And it is, mm-hmm, incredible that here in what, you know, many would think he would just kind of, like you said, hang around Jackson, do some VFW, yeah, shows. And, yeah, you know, you and him got together, started the band, and took off. Right. And I always thought that was so great. And I, you know, anytime I got to the privilege to work with Fluke, I always got the privilege to work with you, and it was a, yeah, great privilege. And you and him made a great team, and you have done so much for the legacy of Johnny Cash and Fluke Holland and, yeah, all of the behind the scenes stuff you were doing to keep him busy. And I just want to thank you as a fan for what you have done. And this book, I mean, this book that just come out, I mean, he had so many great stories, and you have preserved them for everybody.
Yeah. That's been one of my main functions for the past 13 years, was archiving photographs, videos, and stories.
Yeah.
And he would tell me every so often, he'd be telling one of his stories to somebody out on the road or even on stage, and he'd say, I know Ron gets tired of hearing these stories. And I said, no, man, I don't. I want to know them. There's coming a day when I want to know every one of those stories, word for word. And it paid off, because that's basically where the book came from, and it's where the audio that you gave reference to there, which is really not the book in audio form. It's just certain clips out of the book, and it actually came first, and then the book was written. So there's so much more in the book. But that was from an internet radio show we did. We did 42 episodes, I think, at JohnnyCashRadio.com. So we took clips,
yeah,
that,
gotcha,
audio, and then the book was an afterthought. It happened after that.
Okay, but, I see.
Really, basically what I did was just what I knew to do, and that was to book entertainment, to play the guitar a little bit, and just really hang on and have a good time, you know, because if you were around Fluke and Joyce, his wife, too, you're going to have a good time.
Oh, yeah.
Because I've told a lot of people they enjoyed life more than I guess anybody I've known. They just embrace the opportunity to get up every day and have fun and enjoy being together and when we got to go out and play music. So
absolutely.
It was totally a labor of love and something I really honestly and sincerely, Adam, believe God called me to do.
Oh, yeah.
Because just the way it all fell together. You know?
No doubt.
But we had a lot of fun.
Well, I wanted to take time and recognize and honor that in you, because you've done a great thing. And I know a lot
Thank
of people,
you.
it means a lot to a lot of people. So WS got his start it's weird. His nickname is Fluke, and yeah. People sometimes think it's because of the fluke of how he got started on the drums, but it's not really. Could you tell that story?
I can, and that's as good a story as any, because it actually is is realistic. He got the nickname Fluke when he was just a teenager, and he lived in Bemis, Tennessee. He and his mom, and his mom had remarried after his father had passed away when Fluke was 10. So there was a service station where all the guys would hang out, the teenagers would hang out. And so Fluke would go down there, and Fluke being Fluke, you know, he said he was born a little smart aleck, and he grew up to be a big smart aleck, but he would always have something going on. But the guy that ran the service station, I can't remember his name, but if Fluke was in there helping him work on a car or doing something, he would, trying to be funny, he would say, "Hand me that Flukas. Give
right.
me that Flukas, you know. Maybe a wrench, maybe a hammer, but hand me that Flukas." And they'd go, "What? What are you talking about?"
Yeah.
So when the guy would see him coming outside, coming up to the service station, he said, "Well, here comes Fluke."
Right.
And that's where it came from, and it stuck. There are people literally around the world that know him as Fluke more than they do WS. They may get the WS mixed up and say WC or WT, but that Fluke, they know who Fluke Holland is.
Right.
And was. And that's the true story, but it really intermingles with his life and career because of so many things were Fluke happenings. I mean, not really, because we know all things happen for a purpose.
Right.
But it just looked like he just fell back over into a great life and
yeah.
career, and he'd be the first one to say so, you know.
Yeah, that's I mean, the music business can be like that in a lot of ways, but especially back then. And since we were talking about his name, one time I asked him, "Well, what does WS stand for?" And if I recall, I think he just looked at me and said, "I don't know."
No, it doesn't stand for anything.
Yeah,
it was kind of a common thing back in the South, back in those days. He was born in 1935, but it was kind of common to give your male children initial names.
Okay,
you know, like
yeah.
JD or JT.
Okay,
my maternal grandfather's name was ID.
Wow,
and it didn't stand for anything.
Okay,
Fluke told me one time, he said, "There's no periods, just WS. It's just like a name, Joe, Bob, or Tom, WS." And of course, he would tell people in interviews and things, they would ask him about what it stands for. And he said, "Well, it doesn't really stand for anything, but my parents knew that I wasn't going to be very bright. And they gave me a name that could be spelled easily."
That sounds just like it. Well, so he's just working and hanging out, and he goes and sees a band. So this is the mid-50s, early mm-hmm. 50s, and he goes and sees Carl Perkins and Carl's brother. Is that correct?
Well, actually, he and Carl's brother, Clayton, that played the upright bass for the band, had become friends already. They went to school together
okay.
at David Young High School there in Bemis.
Right.
And, then, of course, he told him, he said, "My brother has a band, and I play in my brother's band." So WS would go at night and just hang out with the guys, you know, and listen to the music and stuff. And that's how he actually got started going. He had no interest in being a musician, no particular interest in music. And one night they were playing in this place not far from where I'm talking to you from right now. And Clayton played upright bass, doghouse bass, as we call it.
Right.
And Fluke would get up on an up-tempo song and go up to the bass and keep time on the curvature of the bass. You know how the cutaways are on the bass. And just keep time with it. He said, I don't have a clue why I would do something that stupid. But he said, I did, you know. And he said one night after they got through and they were packing up, he said, I'd hang around with them, you know, while they were packing up. And he said, Carl said, W.S., we're going to Memphis on Thursday, and we have an audition booked on Thursday at Sun Records.
Wow.
And he said, we're looking at maybe getting a record contract. And he said, borrow a set of drums and go with us. And he said, what am I going to do with any drums? He said, I can't play them. You know, and he said, well, you keep time on that bass, you can play on drums too. So, long story short, he went and actually found a guy here in town that he did not know and went up to him and said, I need to borrow your drums, because this guy was a drummer, played, you know, some of the ballrooms around by the name of Slick Glisten.
Yeah.
And he said, you going to borrow my drums? He said, you can't even play drums. He said, well, if you loan them to me, I'll be playing by Thursday. So, and he did. He took them to his mother's house. He set them up backwards. Instead of having this sock symbol or the hi-hat over on the left, he had it on the right.
Right.
He said it just made sense to me because I wouldn't have to cross my arms to play like most drummers. You know, he played an open-hand style.
Yeah.
And Fluke was naturally left-handed. So it kind of worked to his advantage there, too.
Right.
So they went to Memphis and played an old song for Sam for the audition, a song called Movie Mag. And it's a song about that Carl Perkins wrote, I think, when he was 14 years old. And it was a song about an old country boy, old farm boy, sharecropper boy, taking his girlfriend Mag to the movies on the back of a mule. And that's what the song was about. And there was something about the song that Sam Phillips liked.
Really?
He signed him to a recording contract that day.
And, over a song with riding a mule.
Exactly. And W.S. said on the way home, he said it was so ridiculous because on the way home, he said they were joking back and forth about how we went down there and got a recording contract and can't even play, you know, and stuff like that. So that would have been great to have been in that car and hear that conversation.
Oh, yeah.
But that's where it started.
My goodness. It's truly a crazy fluke thing how he, first of all, I can see him walking up on stage and playing on the side of a bass.
Yeah.
Because that's something he would do anyway, for fun.
Just having fun.
Yeah. Yeah,
exactly.
And he is W.S. was always a natural born entertainer. You know, just the way he sat at a table in Shoney's, and what would happen just to sit there with him was entertaining in itself. It was amazing.
Yeah, you're right.
So he records a few sessions with Carl Perkins at Sun Studio.
Right.
And now comes Blue Suede Shoes.
Right. That was three sessions in. That was their third recording.
Unbelievable. So three sessions in, he knows enough to go, well, it's one for the money, but he knows enough to do that.
Exactly.
And that song becomes a massive, massive hit for Carl Perkins and Sun Studios.
Yeah, it sure did.
Yeah. I mean,
Carl had just written that song. And I mean, just like a matter of days before. And of course, Sam was always saying, well, what are we going to record? What do you want to record? And by the way, that brings up a good point. W.S. said, you know, he said, people say, well, Sam Phillips was a brilliant musical genius. And he said, Sam was a nice guy, but he wasn't a genius. But he was smart enough to let those boys do what they knew how to do. and that was played that old rock and roll music.
And oh, so yeah.
He would say, well, what are we going to record? And Carl told him, I've got a song called Blue Suede Shoes. So he said, let her rip.
Wow.
And that's where it came from. That's where it came from.
That, well, and at this time, they're touring with Johnny Cash, correct? On the weekends?
Well, at this time, that was in December of, no, it was back in December of 55 when they recorded Blue Suede Shoes.
Okay.
It was released on New Year's Day, 56.
Wow.
And Johnny came during the year of 55, so they were doing some shows with Johnny Cash, Carl Perkins' band with WS, and some of the other guys had started coming to Sun by this time, and Sun Records would book them. They had a little booking agency they put together.
Right.
And they would book them around the Mid-South area, you know, the adjacent states and so forth. And so they were playing some shows at that time. But when Blue Suede Shoes came out in January of 56, and it really hit and hit big. Then they really got to touring. And Elvis toured with them, too. They did a what they called back in those days a package show, which would be several bands on it. They just happened to be all some artists, you know. But that's how their touring started, and that's how they started working with Johnny Cash. After John came, he and Luther and Marshall came to Sun Records, and they all became friends. I've heard Fluke say that the Perkins Band and Johnny Cash's Tennessee Two said that they all just kind of hit it off, became special friends and everything. They would travel in each other's cars because they all went in cars back in those days.
Yeah.
Rather than go play. But that's how he got real close to Johnny and Luther and Marshall.
So at the time, Johnny Cash has the Tennessee Two, as you just mentioned. And that was a guitar player, and that was also a bass, but not drums.
No drums.
So you've got Marshall Grant on bass, Luther Perkins on guitar, Johnny playing the rhythm and singing, no drums. Mm-hmm. And so let's jump to, well, actually, before we jump to Johnny, there was one thought I just wanted to ask you about.
Yeah.
I heard WS say on the audio stories of My Life with Johnny Cash, which can be purchased by on the website, correct? Fluke Collins website. So he talked about how he was juggling touring with Carl Perkins and also working for an air conditioning company.
And how he would
make a little bit more money on the road than he was making all week at the air conditioning company.
Exactly.
And the funniest thing was where he said, you know, these pretty girls would want to hang out after the show and invite you out to a party. And he said, I'd never got it. I never saw pretty girls invite me to a party when I was installing an air conditioner.
Exactly.
And that was a big role.
Nobody ever asked me to stay over and have a party.
Yeah.
And they played down in Helena, Arkansas, which was kind of a hot spot at that time. And he said on the way back, they stopped to get a hamburger and said they had, I don't know, I'm going to say they had about $20 a piece. And he told the band, Carl and his brothers, he said, I'll work all week and make just a little bit more than this. And he said, here we are, come down here and got to play and made in one night, made almost as much as I'm making a week. He said, you boys can do what you want to. I'm going to stay in the music business. And he did for the rest of his life.
Absolutely. Well, there was... Carl is in a bad car accident. Was this in 56?
Yeah, I think it was in 56. I forget the exact date. They were going to be on the Perry Como show up in New York. And it was Fluke, Clayton, and JB played the rhythm guitar. Carl and another guy, and I can't think of his name. It should be right on top of my head. But he was a disc jockey in Memphis.
Mm-hmm.
And he went with him to help drive on this tour. And they were up in the state of Delaware. It was said it was, I think at the time, it was the only 4-lane divided highway in the United States.
Wow.
And long story short, the guy driving, he had just taken over driving from Fluke. Fluke was driving. And he would stop and get a Coke out of a machine, a Coca-Cola. And he would rub it on his face to wake him up. You know, he did that. And this guy said, well, Fluke, if you want me to, I'll drive a while. And he said, well, that'd be good. So he got over in the passenger side. And then this guy, I wish I could think of his name, I think it's in the book. But he drove and he fell asleep apparently because they run up on the back of a farmer's truck. And the farmer got killed. He was killed in the accident. And Carl had a broken back and almost drowned. And Fluke rolled him up out of the ditch to save his life. Fluke woke up sitting in the middle of this highway on the center line. Not a scratch, wow. Not a bruise, not a pain. He was over on the passenger side, and that's pretty much where the car hit guardrail. You've seen these old-fashioned guardrail posts. They would use creosote posts and drive them into the ground. They went back to the accident scene later, and when the car hit it, it pulled 11 of them up out of the ground. That's how fast they were going. So the guy must have fell asleep and inevitably, you know, put his foot on the accelerator or something. But Fluke was the only one that wasn't hurt, and his drums were in the trunk, and there wasn't a scratch or anything on them. So everybody else had injuries. And pretty serious injuries too.
And that kind of took the wind out of the sails of all the success they were having at the time with Blue Suede Shoes. Is that correct?
It did to some degree, Adam, but we talked about that, and he said, you know, people say, well, about the time of the wreck, Elvis released Blue Suede Shoes. Okay, Carl had already released it in January of 56 that year. Then Elvis came out with it, and everybody said, well, that's what happened to Carl's career. You know, that he was out of whack and Elvis got all the glory. But it was Elvis. I mean, he could record Happy Birthday, you know, and outshine a lot of artists on this. So I don't think it was really as much that as it was just the fact that it was Elvis that did it. And he had better distribution. And by this time he was doing some things, and that's about the time I think he went to RCA, and they probably put a lot more promotional money behind him.
For sure,
but, it did have a bearing on Carl's career to some degree, but I don't think it's as much as sometimes people seem to think.
Gotcha. So WS within a few years is back in Jackson, and he thinks he's done with the music business. In 1960.
After Carl and Blue Suede Shoes, that began to wane. WS met another guy by the name of Carl Mann, who recorded Mona Lisa. He had had a million seller on Mona Lisa at Sun Records. He carried Carl Mann to Sun Records and got him a recording contract. Well, wow. He inevitably became Carl's manager and played drums for Carl, and they did some touring with Carl, too, there for a while. But then about 59, 60... it was late 59, I guess it was. That situation changed, too. And Carl had a pretty bad drinking problem in those days. And Carl's still living, by the way. He just beat COVID, I understand.
Wow, I'm not surprised.
He's still with us, man. He's tough.
That's awesome.
But it's when Johnny Cash called him, and Joyce and Fluke had married on Valentine's Day 1960. And he had got a job, go to work, do the marriage thing, you know.
Right.
And John called and wanted him to do 2 weeks. And he went to do 2 weeks with him, and it turned into 37 years.
What a career. My goodness.
I'm telling
you. So he's Johnny Keys. The Tennessee 2 gets renamed the Tennessee 3 at this point. Because Johnny, he loved having that train beat behind him like that. I mean.
He did.
Yeah.
And all the train beat was, you see, Fluke Holland doesn't get the credit that he deserves as an innovator. Mm-hmm. He would innovate not only music, but other things he would do. He was an innovator. And he innovated that train sound because he heard what Johnny was doing. Johnny would put a dollar bill in between his guitar strings and just get that snare sound. And so Fluke said, I wanted to do something that would complement that or be able to replace it, you know. And so that's where he came up with he has some great stories about how he actually created these different sounds that basically only Fluke Holland does, you know.
You know, and that's true. I mean, a lot of drummers try to mimic what Fluke did, and it's I have yet to hear any of them nail it because he had such a unique way, and I think it was his – his approach to it was not one of, well, here's a set of drumming rules, and I'll, within that understanding, I'll try to create. Yeah. He just did whatever. You know, it's like, oh, that's what Johnny Cash.
He heard it in his head, man, and he just knew how to do it. He just absolutely, that was one of the gifts he had. He could hear something or see something, and he could innovate it. He could take it a step further, or he could make it his own, you know, kind of like Johnny Cash did with most every song he ever did. Mm-hmm. If you wrote a song and Johnny Cash recorded it, forget it, man. It's Johnny's song now.
Oh, you know, no doubt.
That's the way Fluke was. Same way on drumming.
One of the greatest records that I can remember with Fluke playing on was the old wreck of 97. Just that. Yeah. What he's doing on the hi-hat and the snare, it is unbelievable. And the speed of which he keeps it going, you know, it's like, golly.
A lot of that is done with one wrist. All those out of 16, 30-second notes, I don't know what they are, but they're incredible. And he's doing it basically with one hand.
To be a guy that just never picked up drums until he was an adult and got asked to go to Sun Records and then... Yeah. Be an innovator like that and have it all within himself to just do that. It is incredible. And we talk about, we kind of joke about the Fluke thing. We know that that's how God works, you know?
So exactly.
That's what's cool about it. So
see what he was doing when he made Fluke Hall, and that's for sure, because he had so many career highlights and events and things that happened and in his life too, you know. And we haven't even touched on the fact that Fluke was a champion speedboat racer.
Right.
He could build those engines and tear them down and put them together, and then broke speed records. He was 3 times a national champion boat racer. Almost died like 3 times in the act of driving the boats. So he was as good at doing that as he was doing music and vice versa. Yeah. Whatever he picked up, you know, he would learn to do. He'd pretty much master.
He was great. I remember him showing me that boat he had in his garage years ago and talking about the speedboat stuff, and I was just blown away at the life. He lived life to the fullest.
He did. He did every day, man. He had fun. He, and more than having fun, he enjoyed his life. And Fluke was a giver. He was a giver because he liked to give to people. If there's something he could do to help somebody, you know, he would do it. I can't tell you how many times we've been driving along out on the road somewhere, you know, maybe be in a rental car or something, and he'd see somebody on the side of the road, he'd just say, pull over.
Yeah. Well,
I knew what was coming. He was going to get out and give somebody some money or lend them a hand or do something. He always had a real appreciation for his lot in life and where he came from and where he was going to, you know.
Right.
I used to really get tickled at him talking about being backstage with Johnny Cash and Carl Perkins. He said they would get together and start telling stories about how much cotton one could pick and the other one try to outdo him, you know. And Fluke never picked any cotton. He basically come from a pretty well-to-do family, to be honest with you. His dad had like 3 or 4 businesses.
Okay. You know?
And he said one night I just got disgusted with listening to it. And he said, I stood up and I said, look, y'all get back here every night or two and talk about how much cotton you pick and how much you did. He said, I never pick cotton. He said, my family had a little money and I never had to pick cotton, and I'm not going to stay and listen to it.
I can see him saying that.
Absolutely, man. I can too.
Well, when I was listening to the audio of the series you did with him, My Life with Johnny Cash.
Right.
I was dying laughing at this story I had never heard until this audio, and there's a lot of them on there, a lot of good ones. One of them had me falling out. It was about embarrassing. I'm sitting there trying to listen to this. I'm just falling out. You know, people are looking at me. I got my earbuds in. And it was when they were doing the Johnny Cash TV show, and I can't remember the name of the musician, but he just got so sick of that guy playing the mandolin. Could you recapture that story for us to tell that one?
It took them a week to do a show. They would have rehearsals, then they'd have a dress rehearsal, and then I think on Friday night they actually did the show.
Okay, yeah.
He said we had a lot of downtime, and he said we would just sit around. He said at the Ryman at that time is where they did the show. He said they had old church pews, not only out front for the people to sit on, but backstage for the entertainers to sit on. Then he said we were sitting there one night with the Statler brothers, Don Reed and Harold Reed and all the guys, and Flew Collin. And this guy's name was Norman somebody, a very well-known session man in Nashville.
Oh, yeah.
Many years. I can't think of his name.
folks, just go to download the book My Life with Johnny Cash and you'll hear this, you all this, but let's keep listening to Ron, because Ron's, I love this is great.
he said that Norman would just sit there and noodle with the mandolin constantly. And he said we got so sick of hearing that, and he said finally one night I said, Norman, that's a pretty nice mandolin you got there. How much would you sell it for? He said, I've been thinking about taking mandolin lessons and learning how to play. He said, well, yeah, that'd be good. He said, how much would you sell me that mandolin for? And he said, well, it's not for sale, Flute. He said, well, I know, but he said, if you were going to sell it, what would it take to buy a mandolin like that? He said, oh, I don't know, maybe $300. And he said, I don't know where we got the money, but between us and the Statlin brothers, he said, we raised $300. And he said, I give it to Norman. He said, he said, I'm buying your mandolin. So he said, he sold it to me. And so we were sitting on one of those old pews. I was sitting next to Norman, and he said, at the end of the pew, there's this big round armrest.
Yeah.
And he said, I just reached and took the mandolin by the neck from Norman and just wham right against that. And he said it went in about 1,000 pieces, strings and wood, keys. And he said Don Reed of the Statler brothers jumped up and started jumping up and down on the mandolin on the floor. He said they were celebrating. And he said Norman went berserk.
Oh, I bet.
He said, he doesn't like me to this day. He said, no, wait a minute. I paid you for that man. That's my mandolin now.
That's right. He owned it.
But he would do things like that. He was pretty much, they were some of the original rock and roll wild men, I guess.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the stories they had with tearing up hotel rooms and all that stuff, it's incredible. And it's all in the book, yeah. Man Behind the Man in Black. I want to mention that again, because that's a new release this year.
Right, come out in 2020.
Yeah, so that I got to get
them. Sold them very well. They're selling great, and they're going all over the world.
I'm sure they are. Yeah,
Europe, Australia, all the European countries and stuff. So we're really excited about that.
Well, I'm excited to find out that the book has more than the audio. I listened to the audio, all excited, and hear the books just. Yeah. Got more than that, so I'm going to get the book too. That's awesome.
If you will send me your mailing address, I'll send you a book.
Well, I'll be sending you some money for that, but yeah,
I don't want you to pay for it. I'm going to give it to you.
I want to promote it for sure, but anyway, I want to buy it from you. I wanted to mention Boy Named Sue.
Yeah.
So first of all, Boy Named Sue is one thing. But the iconic prison shows, Live at Folsom Prison in 1968, and in 1969, Johnny Cash at San Quentin, which, by the way, that was the first one I listened to. I had heard the single Folsom Prison off of that album for years on the radio and stuff, but when I went in Walmart and bought me a Johnny Cash album, the first album I bought was Live at San Quentin, and I'm not really sure why. I might have just been the only one there.
Maybe.
And I was blown away. It changed my life. And the reason it did, I wanted to be a songwriter when I heard that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I loved country music and I loved the entertainers. But when I heard Johnny coming out of my car speakers singing San Quentin, yeah. You've been living hell to me.
Absolutely.
I was freaking out. And so when I got to meet Fluke Holland and know that he was on these records and he was there, he was on stage, and you know, I still get chills.
Absolutely.
And so another, so we had the hit Folsom Prison was basically Johnny cut that at Sun Studio years before. And then here he is, he does a live version at Folsom Prison. Yeah. That becomes a big single. So now the next year, Columbia is all excited. Let's get another album in the prison, which they weren't excited originally, correct?
No. I don't know how excited Columbia was. I know Flu Collin wasn't very excited about it. Because he told them it was a ridiculous idea, then it wouldn't pay for the tape.
Yeah.
at last count, I know it's gone triple platinum.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, and he tells that story with a big smile on his face, too. That's true. I mean, nobody could have predicted what happened with those two albums. And so here it is. He's singing, Johnny's at San Quentin now. Is there going to be another single that comes off the album? And they have a set list, I imagine. And Johnny Cash pulls a piece of paper out of his pocket, and the band don't know the song.
Exactly.
And that's the song that becomes one of Johnny's iconic hits.
No doubt about it.
Boy Named Sue.
So it was actually a poem written by Shel Silverstein. Shel was in Nashville a lot at that time, and he wrote children's books and poems. And he did a monthly article for Playboy magazine, so I've heard that. And you know, he would write about different topics and stuff. But that's where it came from. Shel wrote it and sent it to Johnny. Johnny just pulls it out on stage and starts reading it like in a sing-songy kind of way. And that's where it happened. Of course, they were recording that day. Carl Perkins stood right behind Johnny. He picked up the rhythm and the metering of it, and he just started a little Carl Perkins riff. And then when he did that, they had no stage monitors or anything back then. Didn't use them back then. Well, when Carl started his little guitar riff going along with what Johnny was doing, Fluke could hear. So he picks up the rhythm on the drums, and then therefore the rest of the guys picked it up, and that's how they played it. And he said, well, we got back to Nashville. They went in and going to piece it together and see what they could, if they could get something good enough to release. And Fluke said, and they never did get anything good to release, but they released it anyway. And it became just a super, super hit song for Johnny Cash.
Well, that's amazing when you think about, if you listen to that record and you think about what you just said, where you hear Carl playing, and that's what Fluke heard. So Fluke, because the amp is probably closer to him than anything. So he's sitting there listening to Carl Perkins play guitar.
Exactly.
And you can tell that when Carl digs in a little bit more and gives more volume, that's when Fluke does it. And they're connected.
That's right. They exactly are. Here a few months ago, I had the opportunity of my good friend Stan Perkins, which is Carl Perkins' oldest son, invited us over to play some music and just hang out. And we did, and he takes a guitar case down out of the corner, lays it down on the floor and flips the clips and opens it up. And it's I forget exactly what kind of guitar it was. He said, this is the one Dad played on Boy Named Sue.
Oh, my goodness.
It was almost a religious experience, man, sitting there looking at that, you know, and thinking about the story of how that song came about. And it's just amazing, man.
Yeah. Well, and what a cool thing that Johnny Cash brought Carl Perkins back out on the road with the Tennessee Three. I mean, that's just that added a whole nother dynamic to their show and their sound. But
it did.
So cool. So what do you feel, what is your take on the impact of the Johnny Cash TV show, the way that impacted the music industry in Nashville in particular?
Yeah. I think it was totally innovative for its time. It was unique. And the best thing that ABC TV ever did was they give Johnny Cash free rein to do what he does. Excuse me. And they let him suggest guests. if you remember, if you look, go back now and look at the old reruns of those shows, it was a very unlikely guest that Johnny had. All the country music shows back then used country artists as guests, but Johnny didn't. He kind of used what was contemporary at the time. People like Ray Charles, Bob Dylan, Linda Ronstadt, and there's just so many of those guys. So that show left a lasting impact on the TV industry, on the entertainment industry, and certainly on country music, because it showed that you can branch out a little bit and do different things within the confines of your main genre and so forth. And I think that's what that show will be talked about and remembered for a long time, because it was that way. So I think it had a major impact. And it told people like you and I, of course, it's way back before your time, but I remember when it was on. But looking back at the old ones, it's inspiring to us even now to know and realize that they did something totally different, and it worked great. It worked beautifully. So don't just stay in your little box. You know, be willing to kick those sides out if you need to a little bit.
So right.
That's what John did.
Johnny was fearless, and what I also love is that you look through the decades of his career there.
Yeah.
Right behind him is Flu Calling.
That's right.
You go through YouTube and you just look, you know, from the TV shows in the 60s that he was doing, the appearances, all the way up to the actual show Johnny had, and on into the 80s and 90s. And exactly. Fluke played for presidents, the Queen of England.
Yeah.
Prisoners.
Carnegie Hall.
My goodness.
Prison shows and men. TV shows, major TV shows, and every now and then I'll come across a YouTube video of some other major deal that they did, and there's old Flu Calling right there in the middle of it.
Right.
PBS has been running a Johnny Cash show. I forget what it was, but they've been running it on their national PBS station and so forth, and there's W.S. Holland right there behind John.
Wow. Now.
So it's just a... He had I think they really had an influence on each other. They had a very special friendship, but they had a very special working relationship as well. And he put a lot of stock in W.S. Holland, and they were confidants. They really were.
No doubt. Well, Fluke made a big impact along with Johnny's music. And, you know, I'd like to mention this, that the podcast is about Fluke. It's about you, Ron, and Johnny Cash, kind of all three of y'all. But I want to mention, just jumping off of what you said about Fluke and his big heart that he had.
Yeah.
How generous he was. He's a giving man.
Oh, absolutely.
I say all this to say that the podcast ain't about me, but I want to mention something that I experienced with WS.
Yeah, sure.
I had just moved to town, and I didn't know. I knew one guy, and his name was Jack Props.
Yeah,
and Jack, he was the one guy that kind of knew people in the Nashville area. And Jack asked me to go see Fluke, and I said, "What, are you serious? W.S. Holland is playing somewhere tonight?" He said, "Yeah," and it was in Lawrenceburg, Tennessee.
That's right,
and you were there that night, and we went. Mm-hmm. We went to that show, and I remember after the show, I was just hoping to get to shake his hand.
Yeah,
and I thought that'd be exciting.
Sure.
Not only did I get to shake his hand, he put me on the bus and took me to Shoney's.
Yeah,
and then had me go get the guitar out of the car that Jack Props drove over to Shoney's, because I rode in the bus. And had me play songs for him in Shoney's, and I'll never forget, he played the table.
Yeah.
Played as I was playing guitar, and I just remember calling my mom and my dad and everybody and just saying, "I can't, but you're not going to believe what just happened." And fast forward, I'm a nobody, and he drove all the way up from Jackson to play for three songs, play drums with me for three songs at Bluebird Cafe. And I tried to pay him, and he wouldn't take a dime for it.
Yeah, yeah.
and that happened multiple times. Just little insignificant shows and an insignificant artist in all reality when you look at the big picture. And this guy is willing to, hey, I'm available. I'll come play. He just wanted to play.
Yeah, he did. I'll tell you something I've never told you before, and I'm not telling it to you because we're talking tonight. I've told it to other people too. W.S. Holland really believed in you. Whatever you did, you got his attention that night. That's the night we was at Shoney's in Lawrenceburg, and you did Shot in Reno.
Yeah.
I've heard him talk about that song over and over again, man. He loves that song, and he just loves you, and he loves your talent. So it was a genuine, you could say once-in-a-lifetime thing that just really, everything was aligned and everything happened well, because I know you guys became real good friends that night, and then you and I became friends that night, and Jack Props is a great friend of ours now too. We work and play some shows with Jack and everything.
Absolutely.
So that's the way it was with me for 13 years. It was just one instance after another, and Fluke made it special, man. He really did, because he had a real genuine appreciation of talent, and he helped so many people either get into the business or to advance their careers in the music business and stuff that people really don't know about. It was all done kind of behind the scenes and everything, but he really loved helping young artists like yourself at the time get things started and do some things and just be appreciated and noticed. That meant a lot to WS.
Sure. Well,
he really did. He was a genuine guy. He had kind of a gruff exterior sometimes, and in some people's impression of him was he was kind of arrogant. That was just WS, because I think he would let people in he wanted in.
Absolutely. You know?
And I think he had a sense of knowing some people he didn't want to let in, you know.
Well, he had a good sense of people, so he knew.
He did.
Yeah.
He did. He really did. I think in his own personal life, not to get real personal about it, but I think losing his dad at the age of 10 years old, and we've sat and had several discussions about his life and growing up. He's taken us down to Saltillo, my wife and I, and he and George two or three times. And George would say, they don't want to go down there and see all that old stuff. And he'd say, well, I want to go see it. So we'd get in the car and go down, and he would tell these stories, man, just unbelievable, you know, about his growing up. And I think that had an impact on WS, and I think he kind of not really built a wall, but just kind of had a force field there that he could operate and let people in and not. And the people that he did appreciate, he was very gracious and very generous and giving. So I'll always remember that about him.
Well, he sure picked a good one in you, Ron.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah,
I appreciate you.
I'm glad that I've gotten to know you through him, and even, you know, there's several big shows that he got to help me be a part of, you know, and get on because he was willing to do it, and you were willing to go through all the trouble of all the logistics and all the set lists and all the things that we would get you involved in, and you just y'all both had such a great presence, great attitude, and you that's just who you are, but that's why y'all made a good team, and I'm very grateful, and that's why you were on the top of my list of people I wanted to talk to when I was starting this Chasing That Neon podcast, because there's been people who they start out and they're just, you know, like Fluke, they got no idea what they're doing, and then next thing you know, they're at Sun Studio and they're around legends and they're playing for the Queen and they're playing on hit records. Yeah. And I think those stories are so fascinating, and I think we have a mutual desire to preserve those. I think we have that
in
common.
Let's keep that alive, because that's very important. We're only one generation away from losing that, you know, man. So
absolutely. Well,
that's what I want to continue doing. We're keeping. We started Drumcat Entertainment back a few years ago. That's kind of the head of the merchandising part of it, and so we want to keep that going. The family has asked us to keep it going, and we're going to keep it going. And I want to keep that legacy alive because it's so educational. If you look at the music business today, it's changed. It's constantly changing. Sure. It's going to change. It's supposed to change. But I think that guys like Fluke Holland, Johnny Cash, the Tennessee Two, Carl Perkins, and all those guys, they're still teaching us so much if we'll just listen to it.
Absolutely. Well, the common thread with him and all these guys is they might not have known what they were getting into, but they said yes because they said, let's do it. Sure. Let's do it. Yes. And as a musician, if you're just going to boil it down to music or other business, there's a element of risk involved in that.
And that
takes courage. And I think
it does, man.
Yeah,
it really does.
So that's a lesson that can come out of all this. And it applies no matter how much the music business has changed. It applies, sure. You know, that's part of it.
It's still the music business. And those things are still important. Those guys walk the walk and talk the talk.
Yeah.
They kind of kicked the door in. Marty Stewart had a quote if you look at the one of the forewords in the book, he said they basically just kicked their way on through. They made it happen. They didn't wait for somebody to do it or wait for somebody to give them permission. They made it happen. And that's telling it as close to true as it can be.
You know, as before we go, there's one more question that just popped into my head that I have to ask.
Yeah. Okay.
W.S. played drums on the Grand Ole Opry at a time when that wasn't the thing to do. Am I telling that right?
You're telling it exactly right. He has the distinction of being the first drummer to play a full set of drums on the stage of the Grand Ole Opry. Hmm. And of course, was back when it was at the Ryman, and he said he was there one night. Johnny called him the night before at home here in Jackson and told him, he said, Fluke, we're doing the Opry tomorrow night. I want you to bring your drums. He said, up until then, I was just playing a snare maybe, you know, on our shows. And he said, bring the whole set and bring those loud, clangy, clangy things. He said, you talking about the cymbals? And he said, yes, bring those too. And that speaks of W.S. Holland, but it speaks of Johnny Cash. He was the innovator too, man.
Yeah.
So he said I loaded them all up, carried them, and went through the stage door. Was setting up on the stage of the Grand Ole Opry, and there again, I can't think of the guy's name. He was the head of the Opry.
Was it Jim Denny?
No, I think it was before Jim.
Okay.
This was not long after Fluke had started working with John, so it would have been in the early 60s. His name was Bud somebody, I think. But anyway, he comes out, walks out on the stage, and he sees Fluke setting up all this hardware and all these clangy cymbals and stuff, and he says, W.S., what are you doing? He said, I'm setting up my drums for tonight. He said, you can't do that. You can't play all those drums tonight. And W.S. told him, he said, well, all I know is that man back there, Johnny Cash, said he called me and told me to bring all my drums and all these clangy, clangy things, and that's what I'm doing. And he said the guy shook his head and said, if anybody needs me, I'll be in my office. And he disappeared from the stage, and he didn't see him anymore all night. So he played the first full set of drums on the stage of the Opry.
That's why W.S. and Johnny Cash and Carl Perkins and those boys, they were rock and roll. They were
forced to be reckoned with, man.
Yeah.
They really were the first bad boys.
Yeah, no doubt. I love it. Well, thank you so much, Ron, for being a part of this and giving so much time to this evening. It's an
honor.
Thank
you, man. I'll leave you with a W.S. Holland quote. I've heard him tell people this all over the world, literally, and I'm sure he's told you before, but thank you, man, for having me on. It's been a blast, and I wish you all the best. Hope to see you again real soon, and I'll leave you with a quote of W.S. Holland. Thank you for being my friend.
Well, thank you. It's an honor, and thank you for being my friend, Ron. You have a great night, buddy. Y'all check out Man Behind the Man in Black, the W.S. Holland story, the new book that's out. Be sure to get it.
Yeah. How about the website, wsflukeholland.com?
wsflukeholland.com. And that's where you can find Drumcat Entertainment, the merch, all that stuff.
Yeah.
Great albums. There's CDs on there. So, yeah, thank you, Ron. Have a great night, buddy.
You too, sir.